Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Things Have Changed, What Every Parent and Educator Should Know About the Student Mental Health and Substance Misuse Crisis, by David McGee. Narrated by David McGee. Introduction. We want so much better for our children, those we parent and those we teach. It's what we think about and work so very hard at almost every day. Yet we've left the children behind just when they need us most. Really, we have. That's because this generation of students is struggling with substance misuse and mental health issues like never before, facing anxiety, depression, suicide ideation, and eating disorders in startling numbers. They desperately need our help to manage the crisis. For many in this generation, it's now a matter of life and death. For the rest, it's a matter of finding and keeping the joy they deserve, the joy that mental health and substance misuse issues often steal. Consider that the U.S. Centers for Disease Control issued a recent warning, revealing data showing that 44% of students felt sad or hopeless during the past year. The U.S. Surgeon General recently issued an advisory on youth mental health, suggesting the problem is so severe that the future well-being of our country depends on how we support and invest in the next generation. These facts speak the loudest, though. Accidental drug overdose deaths in teens and those in their early 20s are rising sharply, and so are deaths by suicide. That's because things have changed so drastically and so fast that many, a majority perhaps, are struggling to navigate the rigors of daily life, including school, extracurriculars, friends and family. Even if they don't have mental health and substance abuse issues, they'll smile and tell us they are okay because that's what we want to hear. But no, they are not okay. Yes, America, we have a problem. Our children are hurting and at significant risk, and we must get better at how we engage, guide, and educate them. You'd think that in our country, a global leader in education and innovation, we'd be better at guiding and teaching students, given the life-changing facts we know. There's no shortage of research revealing what students face in mental health and substance misuse issues and the most effective solutions. We know, for instance, that students better face life's challenges with more sleep and that social media like Instagram increases the likelihood of eating disorders in teens. Yet, despite countless research findings, students today face a mental health and substance use disorder crisis like never before, making it obvious that critical, life-changing, and even life-saving information is not reaching students and families. That's because research conclusions alone are not enough. We must share the information with students, parents, and educators in an engaging way. That's where I enter this story. I am among the few student well-being activists who have been conducting face-to-face mental health and substance misuse educational talks in schools and universities in recent years. More than once, I was the first speaker to appear before the entire student body in over 2 years, since the pandemic began. Even amid large audiences, sometimes more than 1,000 students gathered in a gymnasium or auditorium, I could tangibly see their pain, often illustrated by tears streaming down cheeks. After hearing my Things Have Changed school talk, many parents, educators, and students asked if I would turn it into a book, which could help them combat this epidemic by providing a clear map outlining the challenges faced and their potential solutions. This book is my response. It's not an assignment I sought, no. This job found me. I plan to finish my career in traditional media, managing news sites or a more diversified content organization. But that's what happens with a calling. It finds us. My journey began in personal and family crisis, suffering from my own substance use disorder, prescription Adderall from a doctor, and alcohol. I lost my marriage and career in my mid-40s. Then, my oldest son, William, an honors college student and track athlete, died of an accidental drug overdose not long after graduating from college. My middle child, Hudson, nearly died of an accidental drug overdose in college. He was found blue and not breathing with no heartbeat at a fraternity house on campus, though he awoke from a coma 2 days later without brain damage. And my daughter, Mary Hallie, struggled with an eating disorder beginning in high school and continuing into college. All this tragedy and crisis occurred in our family within several years, shattering us into pieces. On the day I found our William dead, with so much love and promise gone with his last breath, my hands shook and my stomach quivered with nausea. As word spread, almost everyone who knew us thought this would be more than our broken family could take. But don't feel sorry for me or my family. Yes, we lost our William and miss him every day, and will for as long as we get to see the sunrise. But I got back my marriage, my career, and my joy, thanks to determined recovery. Our son Hudson got his life and joy back as well. After his near death, he got sober at 21 and has remained in recovery for more than a decade. And our daughter is now years into eating disorder recovery and a married mother of three. We all draw strength from William, individually and collectively, as if some of his best parts of his departing soul were divided among us, making us stronger to battle. We don't want other students and families to suffer as we did. That's why 3 years after William died, I wrote the newspaper column, For Ole Miss Freshman, My Son William's Story, in the Oxford Eagle, the small daily that I published. Oxford is the hometown of the University of Mississippi, which William and Hudson attended, as did my wife and I. The newspaper averaged just 5,000 unique readers per day. Still, my column about how William thought he could use substances including alcohol, cocaine, and marijuana in college and just walk away at graduation, but then ended up with a problem he couldn't manage, went viral and was read by more than 1 million people. We used the momentum to help start the William McGee Center for AOD and Wellness Education on the University of Mississippi campus, designed to help students with substance misuse. The effort put me in regular contact with students, many of whom talked openly and honestly about what they faced, deepening my learning and bolstering my calling. Since William's story was just a part of our family saga of addiction, recovery, love, and loss, I wrote the memoir Dear William, my first book in over a decade, bearing the depths of our pain and reclamation of joy. I didn't know what to expect, honestly. They like to say in publishing that only celebrities can write a successful memoir these days. Yet a crowd of more than 700 came to see the November book launch, and momentum spread across the winter the way kudzu grows in these parts in summer. The CBS Morning Show came calling. Yes, that was Gail King and noted senior reporter Jim Axelrod talking about our story on national TV. Parents and teachers read Dear William and told school board members and administrators about it. Soon, one invitation after another came, from New Jersey to Texas to the Mississippi Delta, for me to speak to students. I struck a nerve, writing as a nobody, yet speaking in a voice for everybody, the students, parents, and educators throughout this nation, engulfed in this crisis without help or acknowledgement, like people being held underwater and being told to breathe as if nothing were happening at all. That's why I've devoted my career to this work, advocating for students and families facing mental health challenges and substance misuse. Everyone in the vital student ecosystem needs more understanding about what's happening and how to help students fight back. The effort starts with parents, educators, and healthcare professionals. That's why I wrote this book, mainly for parents, but also for educators and everyone who can help us help the middle, high school, and college students who so need it. It's about how things have changed and what you can do about it. It's about giving our young people their best odds for joy and well-being and the help and guidance they need and deserve. Frankly, I never thought I'd write this book. I remember that the first time I walked into a school to give a speech about how things have changed, a student asked me if I was there to give us a drug talk. And I was thinking, no, oh goodness, no, I'm not that person. I never wanted to be that person. I tried to run from it even. But this job found me because, yes, I am that person. I crawled across the floor, then got myself back up and got myself and my family back into living joyous lives, despite our significant loss. Once there, Students and parents came with questions. How did you save yourself? How did you handle losing a child? How did your other son find success in recovery? What do you wish you'd known when your children were in middle school or in high school? How would you handle a struggling college student who doesn't want help? Is fentanyl indeed everywhere? So many good questions. So many hurting students deserving answers. Indeed, I have lived through our family's breakage and repair, and from that experience, I have built engagement with students and families facing similar problems and seeking solutions for the mental health and substance misuse crisis. So here I am, trying to make the problem clear, as frightening as it may be, connecting the dots from technology to fentanyl, fostering communication between parents and children, and showing that we can change things for your child and for all children. That's the half-full glass that energizes me to do this work. That's the half-full glass that must motivate you to dig in as well. Your children need and deserve it. Chapter 1. The Joy Factor. How we need to communicate with teens and college students is so specific that they'll tune us out if we miss the mark by just a bit. The adult-to-youth dialogue that seems relatively easy when children are 8, 9, and even 10 years old, when they still consider adults wise and humorous, becomes problematic when they reach puberty. The challenge doesn't subside for most young people until late in college, if not beyond. In attempting to connect on the most sensitive personal subjects, like mental health and substance misuse, is even more difficult. Yet, if we can figure out how to meet students where they are on these sensitive subjects by speaking the correct language, a jackpot of engagement awaits. But it's on us, not them, to figure that out. I bring this up at the beginning of this book because our struggle to communicate with students is a frequent obstacle to the education and support they need and is the foundation of the anxiety and depression they experience. That's because the lack of engagement can leave them feeling locked off and lonely when they need it most. We know, for instance, that talk therapy is an essential aspect of mental health. Yet for students facing our fast-moving, complicated world, engagement around their feelings doesn't come easy. They don't have the time, racing through the school day, after-school activities, and everything else in between, much less the emotional aptitude, considering their central nervous system is still rapidly developing, to be told what they are uncomfortable hearing, or even to initiate discussions. They can become deeply emotional but have difficulty expressing emotion. We can indeed reach them, though. I learned this from trial and error in the field, speaking to student groups, including schools and social organizations. Initially, I'd get introduced to someone who was there to talk to them about alcohol and drugs. I'd pass the first test, showing humility and relatability by explaining how I'd struggled with depression, self-medicating with Adderall and alcohol before finding recovery. I'd also share how my children battled anxiety and depression, self-medicated substance misuse, my sons, and an eating disorder, my daughter, before one died and two found recovery. Next, I'd tell students about the risk they face, how things have changed since their parents and teachers were teens, and what they can do about it. Educators told me that the response from students was very good. The majority appeared to listen. Some had questions, and a few even sought counseling or treatment immediately after. Remarkable, a principal told me. We've never had that kind of response to an alcohol and drug talk. It's your humility, I think, and they can relate because you aren't talking down to them. People will tell a speaker what the speaker wants to hear. But I believed the hype, considering myself good at talking to students, because invitations continued. I'd been a communicator for most of my professional life, writing, editing, speaking, and appearing on TV sometimes. I'd never considered how vital my specific language and approach was to connecting with students. Perhaps I was good, but is that good enough when these students face an epidemic? Reflecting upon my talks, I remembered seeing one-third of the students drifting off during my lectures. I figured that was normal because, yes, they were sleep-deprived and overtasked. Of course, a high percentage would naturally nod off during a talk. I thought again, no, I'm not great at reaching students. This principal thinks I'm good because he's comparing me to someone who had half the student body nodding off, not one-third. I think I'm good because my ego is grasping for the compliment. I'm not showing any humility whatsoever in speaking to these students. In fact, I'm not doing the hard work needed to reach them, all of them. I began studying communication techniques that work with teens. I found considerable resources, all generally offering similar tips like listen, don't judge, and do as I do, not as I say. Be a role model. I paused and thought about the time students did come up to me after talks to engage. What did they say when they approached me after talks? Some explained they battled an eating disorder, others marijuana misuse, and others anxiety and depression. Yet each shared a common desire, joy. How do I get to joy and well-being? That's what they asked me with their words and their weary eyes. The following week, I made a straightforward adjustment to the Things Have Changed talk I frequently deliver to students. I decided to hit the stage with energy, a smile symbolic of joy, and a big welcome. Hello, Oxford High School. It's such an honor to be here, and first, I'd like to clear up any confusion. I'm not sure why you think I'm here, but let me tell you why. I'm here for one reason, and one reason only. I care so much about you that I want to help you find and keep your joy. Silence. But I could see them sitting upright, opening their eyes, looking away from their phones. Let me ask, is that something you want? Do you want joy? Mild applause. Let me ask again, I said, turning up my intensity. Do you want joy that you can have and keep forever? Tell me, do you want joy? Yes, they shouted back with enthusiastic applause. 10 minutes into the speech, I was talking about my daughter's eating disorder battle, and I looked into the audience and saw multiple young ladies with tears running down their cheeks. 5 minutes later, I was explaining that street marijuana is now 300 to 400% higher in THC, the ingredient that makes you high, making it addictive and damaging, and a dozen young men were nodding in accord. And so began the story of how a balding man in his mid-50s became a voice and advocate, not for the students, but with the students, thanks to the slightest adjustments to his speech. Instead of giving them the usual alcohol, drug, and mental health talk, I spoke to them about how to find and keep their joy. I made it about them, not about someone in their parents' or grandparents' generation telling them what they should and shouldn't do. Substances steal joy, as do mental health problems. And you'll see this theme resonate throughout this book because I've learned it's the golden key to both reaching and saving our students. Parents and educators today must become joy leaders, helping children unlock and keep the joy they want and deserve. More than getting good grades, more than winning a championship, they want sustainable joy. Yet we don't spend much time or effort on helping them see how to achieve that. We're so busy telling them what they need to do, over and over again. It's a wonder they don't run away from home and never come back. Wait, yes, but many do. Smoking marijuana or purging the family dinner once out of sight while parents pour themselves an evening glass of wine, basking in a warm glow and considering the day a success. We assume we know what will give children joy, things like being great at playing the violin or soccer, acing algebra, or swimming faster than the others at lessons, and we shove all of that and more at them through high school and into college. Speaking of college, we don't even want them to have a mediocre dormitory room. It's got to be better than the others, because, sure, that will bring them joy. So we help them decorate it to surpass the others, but don't understand when they call home, crying midway through the first month on campus, feeling lost and lonely. Just focus on what you have, dear, we'll say. You have everything. That great dorm, so many friends. But, Mom. Maybe the decked-out dorm room gives them joy, or not. I don't know. I'm not criticizing the details and efforts that make life and its experiences fun. Decked-out dorm rooms can be fun, absolutely. I'm just making a point. It's that I have heard and learned directly from students that the thing they want most out of life is joy. Joy that lasts. Finding joy is the message landing in a sweet spot for teens and college students. How we communicate with students determines whether we effectively reach them or not. And whether we get through to them or not has so much to do with their momentary state of anxiety and depression. I wish I had understood this better when my children were teenagers. Often when I speak to students and take their questions, one will ask, "If you could go back and do anything differently, what would it be?" I have the same answer every time. I'd be a better communicator. I wanted so much good for my children, and I was so sure that I knew what was good, or would get them to that good, that I frequently told them how they should feel and what they should do. Yet the anecdotal evidence and research shows that's not how children best thrive. My profession was communications. I was a writer. Yet with my children, the ones who mattered most in my life, I was too often a one-sided communicator. I learned the hard way that this didn't work. Once we lost our son William to an accidental drug overdose, I changed my communication behavior with my other two children, who were still in college. Instead of telling them what they should do, I asked them what they wanted to do and listened. Instead of judging their behavior, I modeled my own, and it made all the difference. Now, I work hard at communicating with students on their terms, not mine, and it works much better. It's never easy, but I'm always surprised and delighted at the honesty and engaged feedback that comes my way when I deploy good communication tactics. I now understand how critical it is for parents, educators, and all of us who get to engage regularly with students to always use the best communication practices, because they can and will make all the difference. These include: ask open-ended questions, listen, listen, and listen. Don't accuse or assume you know. Validate children's feelings. They need to be seen and heard. Deliver clear and sincere praise. Self-esteem matters. Engage often over meals and activities, and avoid preaching. Don't judge children or others. Joy matters most. It's not so much about happiness for students, though happiness is good and desired. We want happy students, but no human is happy all the time. We want to strive for something more profound and lasting. Happiness is fleeting, tied to moments, and doesn't always help anchor one's foundation. Yet that's what we parents seek all too often with our children, happiness and affirmation of it so we feel better in the moment. We'll even ask them, obsessively, "Are you happy?" or "How are you feeling?" "Yes, sure," they'll say in words, "I'm feeling fine," before adding body language that says, "Can we move on?" Happiness is a state of mind, or a mood, that often comes from external things or associations. Happiness is so in the moment that it can even double-cross us, making us fear its loss the moment we are experiencing it. Think of watching your team winning a big game. It feels so good, but you can't help think, "Oh no, we play a better team next. I'm afraid we'll lose that game." Joy, meanwhile, is more profound. Less a chaste commodity. Joy runs deeper than a feeling that we are good and okay, and it's a key to a sustained and satisfying life. Well-being involves it all, including happiness and physical and emotional health, and yes, A's and championships can be a part of that too. It's well-being we should want for our children, and it's well-being that we must help them achieve. They need help from parents, educators, in the community, and that help starts here, now. In the sections ahead, I'll cover what students today face that threatens their joy, including social media, dangerous and addictive street marijuana, counterfeit prescription pills, fentanyl, and stigma. But we'll also get into the solutions, how active listening, parent role modeling, early counseling, and other strategies can and will make all the difference. The subject matter may feel heavy at times, or threatening even, because when we effectively, honestly outline what students face in our Things Have Changed world, it's enough to scare most of us into a corner of denial. And for many, that's exactly what happens. But they need you, and they need us all to better understand both the problems and solutions. And they need us to better understand how to help them. The healing journey for your child, or the child you get to teach or otherwise mentor and lead, begins here. Takeaways. How we communicate with teens and college students matters. Preaching doesn't work as well as teaching. They all want joy. We must help them find and keep it. Chapter 2. Break the Stigma. Fear, a strong human emotion that helps us survive, is hardwired into our brains. That water is a long way down from the cliff. Don't jump. The trip is more than we can afford. It's a no-go. Fear saves us. But like all human strengths, fear also works against us, particularly when what we fear becomes stigmatized. Stigma is the mark of shame or discredit, and there are few things we parents fear more than our children being associated with shame or discredit. We'll push back against that with substantial fear, even if it means overlooking an obvious problem. Consider a call I got from the parent of a high school senior, one that illustrates, in essence, how almost every call I get from concerned parents of high school and college students goes. The father didn't know me. He'd gotten my number from a mutual friend who knew about my work with young people on substance misuse and mental health issues and called looking for advice. It was late in the fall semester, and his oldest child, Bill, had all A's, a nearly perfect ACT score, and a starting position on the wrestling team. With his outgoing personality, almost every college and university option imaginable was available. But Bill's graduation from high school was in doubt despite the accolades, thus the father's phone call. My position in accepting such calls is this. I'm not a counselor, and I don't spend even a second attempting to act as one. My goal, always, is to get students or others into counseling or treatment. I serve as a lay interventionist of sorts when people reach out for advice, a common first step involving someone facing substance misuse issues. Substance use disorder is a mental health disorder, meaning almost every case requires professional help. Bill, the father explained, was caught with a handle of vodka on an overnight school trip. The school has a two-strike, no-alcohol policy, and Bill had already been caught once before. For the first offense, Bill had attended a mandatory alcohol and drug awareness class, which included a visit to an open community Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. He knew that another strike meant school expulsion. The father was initially upset with his son, but the son provided a contextual explanation. "It's my senior year," he said. "Everybody else was drinking. I just wanted to have some fun." The school provided a different version of the story. The principal said the school caught several other students with alcohol on the trip, but Bill had the handle of liquor in his room and drank late into the night alone. His trip roommate did not drink. Bill left the half-consumed handle in his room, and the school discovered it on a checkout sweep of all the rooms. "I know my son may not tell me the entire truth," the father said, "but he's usually honest with me. But the school is saying Bill needs to leave for treatment. If he completes a 30-day residential substance program, he can come back, finish the year, and graduate. Otherwise, he's done." The father listed reasons he viewed the treatment option as a bad idea. "He'll get labeled as a drunk. Everyone will know. He'll miss winter sports, his last chance to wrestle. It will follow him for the rest of his life. Besides, he's just having fun. He's a senior in high school.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?